going through the big story, and it's basically the idea of what we might call an overarching meta-narrative, but it just means big story. There's this story, or the story, that we believe all other stories find themselves in. And what we're trying to do is just see how all of our lives, we all have these little stories that fit within the big story that really is God's story. And so we're taking a walk through, in a way, all the Bible. We're going through the Old Testament. We're still in Genesis. We're trying to get a broad overview. So we're trying to see the forest and not just the individual trees. And we've been looking at this story of creation, fall, redemption, and restoration, and what God has been doing in the world and in history. And last time Brent preached, he was unpacking the story of Jacob. And so we've been looking at what God has been doing in these promises that he has made all the way back in the Garden of Eden to make right the wrong that entered into the world when sin entered into the world, when the serpent came and deceived Adam and Eve, and how God has promised that the day would come when these things are going to be rectified, that the seed of the woman would come and crush the head of the serpent. Basically, what I need to do is actually just delve right into the text this morning. This is a lot. This is actually going to be broken into two parts. Thankfully, my wife talked me into that. I was going to try to cover the life of Joseph in one Sunday, like Brent masterfully did with the Jacob account, and there's just too much here. So I'm just going to dive right into the story of Joseph. This fits into the big story, and I think this will kind of flesh itself out as we go. So we're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 37 through 41. There's a lot that I'm going to need to skip, so I want to encourage you to later go and read all of this account from 37 to 41. And then next time I preach, I'll finish this sermon or the second part of this from maybe chapter 42 through 47 or so. So it's going to be good. Even though we're talking about this story, I'm basically just going to tell this story this morning. If you go and read this and let even more of it speak to you. So Genesis chapter 37, starting in verse 2, it says, Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. So we've been going along the lineage of these patriarchs, these fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and now Jacob. He's been renamed Israel. The nation of Israel is being formed. And here we focus in on a family. And we see immediately Joseph, this young 17-year-old man, is introduced to us. And immediately we find that he is bringing a bad report about his brothers to his father. And on top of that, we have Israel, who is loving Joseph more than all of the other brothers in the family. And so there's a favoritism going on here. You know, Tim Keller points out that this idea of a bad report when we're looking at the Hebrew is really like almost always a false report or a misleading one, like what we see in Numbers where the people are called to go and spy out the land, and they come back fearful. Caleb and Joshua are courageous, and then they kind of spin the story. They give some true facts, but they make it sound super frightening so that everybody could be afraid and they wouldn't have to do what God had called them to do, because they didn't really trust in God at that point. And it's that same idea of bringing a bad report, a misleading one. Maybe it was truthful, but in some ways, but it's obvious that he's trying to probably make his brothers look bad in front of his father. And already his father favors him. And so this is a problem. On top of that, his brothers, noticing that their father loves him more, it says they hated him. And it's going to continually remind us of that throughout the story, that they hated him and their hatred for him is intensifying. They can't even speak peacefully to him. And so as we focus in on this family, what we notice immediately is that this is a dysfunctional family. And we've seen this along the way. We've already seen that Isaac himself favored Esau and not Jacob. And there was a bunch of dysfunction, deception, Jacob's mom helping him to deceive his own father, and all this craziness going about. And certainly probably a open sort of a need in Jacob's life having not been favored. And so when you look at Jacob's life and he goes and finds this beautiful woman, Rachel, and he goes through this whole fiasco of being tricked into marrying the sister who's not spoken of as attractive, but he's always trying to go after the attractive girl. Like, if I just had her, maybe this will fill this emotional need. And now you see it being fleshed out in the child from Rachel that he favors. And his emotional center seems to be focused in a disproportionate way on his son Joseph. And so though we've seen that Jacob is a man of faith, he's a man who has grown in the knowledge of God, he, like so many of us, has this tendency to really walk in idolatry, to have a disproportionate amount of affection going towards something else. And so this whole family has this dynamic that basically I think is leading it to the point where they're going to implode. And I think that what we actually encounter here is that again, like we've been seeing all along the way, the promises of God are at stake here. Because the promises that were made in the very beginning to Adam and Eve, and then the promises that were given to Abraham, where God was going to bless all the nations, where he was going to make things right, where he's going to save people, was going to come down to the line of Abraham and his descendants. And here we have the line, and here we have the beginning of the nation of Israel, and the family is in complete disarray. And so as we continue this, and we'll see this unfold more, Genesis 37 verse 5, it says, "Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, 'Hear this dream that I have dreamed.'" Joseph not only likes to bring these bad reports, even if they're truthful, he likes to make his brothers look bad. His father's already made him this robe of many colors, which may have been a robe of many colors, but it may have also just been a robe with long sleeves. Commentators don't know. It gets translated different ways. But the idea is that this robe in those times probably signified the sense of royalty or the sense of authority, and the sense that even Joseph was being elevated to this firstborn kind of status that really would have belonged to Reuben, because Jacob is just favoring this son in a way that is just overt and flies in the face of his brothers. And they see this coat, this reminder that their father loved Joseph more, and they hate him even more. And on top of that, Joseph, instead of coming along to make the situation better, pours gasoline on the fire. He has a dream and he says, "Hey, hear this dream." And basically he comes to them and says, "Hey, there's a bunch of sheaves out in the field, and my sheaves stood up tall, and all your sheaves bowed down to me." So this probably went over really well. Since they already can't speak peacefully to him, he's like there's no tact here. And I think what we're seeing is sort of an unfolding and revealing of Joseph's heart. There's a sort of indifference that he has. Like, they can't speak peacefully to him, and he doesn't even recognize how they feel. It's like he's just completely self-absorbed and self-centered, that he would even tell them this dream. Like, does he not pick up on the fact that he's the only one with this nice robe and no one else got one? And instead, so I think what we see is he's becoming arrogant, that he's kind of just like a spoiled brat. He's kind of been the favorite kid, and he's, instead of like using that for good, he's just like elevating himself even more. He's just kind of a narcissist full of himself. So he has this dream. Now, the important thing when we think about dreams in the ancient world is that dreams in those times, different than today, were almost always thought of to be coming from the divine realm. And you see this throughout the Bible. You see people troubled. Nebuchadnezzar getting his dreams interpreted by Daniel. In this account, Pharaoh and other people who get their dreams interpreted, they're extremely troubled by these dreams. Because unlike today where we just think, "Oh yeah, I had a bad dream or a nightmare," there's some sense where they feel like it's coming from the divine realm, and they're wanting to know what these dreams mean. And so the brothers may have even been more troubled by the fact that this was the reality, and they interpret the dream immediately in this way, and they ask the question of Joseph and says, "Are you indeed to reign over us?" And so they immediately know what Joseph is trying to say, and they're hating him even more. And so what does Joseph do? He has another dream, and he decides, "Well, let me share that one also." So Genesis 37, verse 8, his brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us?" And so they hated him even more for his dreams and his words. So he's just provoking them. And they are intensifying. Over and over, they hated him even more. Their hatred is building for this brother. And this family, this dysfunctional family, is continuing to move to the point of disaster. And then in verse 9, it says, speaking of Joseph, he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers. So he doesn't keep it to himself. Just, wow. He says, behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me. Okay. So basically, this doesn't even go well with his father. His own father, who favors him, ends up rebuking him, and his own father interprets the dream as, shall I, your mother, and your brothers really bow down to you? And his father's like, what's up with this? And it says in verse 11 that his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. So his father's wondering, well, is there some truth to this, even though he's rebuking Joseph? But the brothers were jealous of him. And I think that obviously they're already jealous of him. They're already bothered that their own father favors this younger brother and just treats him with a disproportionate amount of affection and blessing. But now, you know, if they're thinking that these dreams are coming from the divine realm, it's almost like, well, like he gets everything. Like even God is giving him dreams, maybe, that we're going to bow down before him. Like, they're jealous and the hatred is rising. And so as the story continues, we find that Joseph's brothers are off in Shechem. These are shepherd people, and they're pasturing a flock, or at least they're supposed to be there. And so Jacob sends Joseph to check on them. Maybe Joseph is a reliable source to, you know, tattletale if any trouble's going on. He obviously he's not afraid to bring a bad report, so I don't know if that's what's going on. But either way, Jacob wants Joseph to go and check on his brother. And so Jacob gets to Shechem, and he finds a guy there. And his brothers aren't there. And he asks the guy, hey, where are my brothers? And he says, oh, they're pasturing a flock, and they've gone somewhere else. So in verse 7, or 17 of chapter 37, it says, the man said, they have gone away, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. And they saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams. So I think there's a sense here that, you know, they're ready to take this inner hatred that's been rising up and put it to action. Get rid of this dreamer. But there's also this sense here that I think this family and these brothers aren't really believing that they don't really fear God. They don't really have a faith in God. And if they're thinking that these dreams are coming from the divine realm, which as the story progresses, we'll find out they really are, it's almost like, you know, we'll see what will become of his dreams. We'll put an end, maybe. I don't know if that's what it's saying, but maybe they're thinking, you know, even if this is from God, we will put an end to this right now. What will become of his dreams? I think that what we've seen, and I think Brent unpacked this in the story of Jacob, is what we see in this family and what we often see are a people who know about God, but don't necessarily know God. And something happens along the way where they have an encounter with God, where they begin to know God in a personal way. And that is what it means to be a Christian. It's not merely this religious idea that we know about God and we know some theological facts, or we can rattle off some verses from the Bible, or we go to church on Sunday or whatever. The reality is, do we have a relationship with Jesus Christ? Do we know God and not just know about God? And I think that we see this over and over in the lives of the patriarchs. We see this in the lives of these brothers, that God often has to take people even through immense trials and struggle and showing them their failure and bringing them to the place of reconciliation to reveal to them their need for him. And so this message today really is about the sovereignty of God, but it's also a message that touches on suffering and affliction, and the whole story does. And when we think about the sovereignty of God, it's not removed from the idea of suffering, because as soon as we think and believe, and I believe the Bible teaches this, that God is in control of everything, and as soon as we think that, we are posed with an intellectual and an emotional problem. Because if God is in control, then why did this thing happen to me? Or why is that happening over there in the Middle East? Or why? You know, there's a million questions that come into our mind. And it either makes it seem like, well, God can't possibly be in control, or he is in control and he's just like, he's indifferent. He's indifferent to my suffering. He's not even paying attention. He's not hearing my prayers. That, you know, on down the line, all of those questions. But let's continue on in the story. And as we consider the sovereignty of God, I think that we can also see how God uses these very things to lead people to him and to bring about good in his working in the affairs of the world. Genesis 37, verse 21. The brothers are planning to kill him, but Reuben heard it. And he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore. And they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. They sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. So you see here that as this unfolds, the plan is to kill Joseph, but he gets rescued, just happens to get rescued by his older brother, Reuben. And they put him in this pit. And you just see the callousness, basically, of these brothers. That they see him coming, and what's the first thing they do? They get that robe and strip it off. And that robe that makes them sick. That robe that reminds them that their father favors him. And they strip him of that robe, and they throw him into this cistern that's empty. And what do? You know, they sit down to have a meal. It's like just total callousness. And in this story, we just hear we don't hear the suffering of Joseph out loud. He just seems like he's silently suffering. But we know from Genesis 42 that Joseph was in fact crying out to his brothers. I don't even know how close, you know, they're sitting down to eat, if he's hearing them have a conversation about whether or not they're going to kill him. But either way, he's crying out to them within earshot, because they heard him crying out. They heard him begging them. And in Genesis 42:21, it says the brothers are talking. They said to one another, "In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen." So they heard him, they hear him crying out, they hear him begging, they hear him in distress, their little brother, and they sit down to eat a meal. So just total dysfunction in this family, total just callousness. And these are the beginning of God's people, the forming of God's nation. So there's some serious problems here. Something's going to have to happen to deal with this family that is falling apart at the seams. The promises of God are at stake here. Then Judah pipes up and says, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood?" And Judah's not really like this great guy. We're skipping chapter 38. You can read that and just see what kind of dude Judah is. You know, God, the beauty of it is God loves to work and use sinners, you know. Jesus comes from the tribe of Judah, the line of the tribe of Judah, but not because Judah was a great guy. He really was kind of a messed up person. But here there's a little bit of a morality that he has, and he doesn't want to kill his brother. But it does seem like he's probably just keeping his conscience clear. Maybe there's a little inkling that, oh, we might get in trouble, or maybe he feels like, oh, this will be too much. But he doesn't save his brother. He doesn't say, let's call this thing a prank and bring our brother back home and just end this craziness. He says, no, let's sell him to those Ishmaelites that just happen to be coming by. And he says, he is our brother, our own flesh. And so they sell him. The Ishmaelites take him down to Egypt, take Joseph down to Egypt. So Reuben somehow wasn't in this picture when they were eating or when all of this stuff was happening. And we already know that Reuben wanted to come back and rescue his brother out of their hands. So Reuben comes back. He sees that Joseph is gone, and he tears his clothes and says, "The boy is gone, and where shall I go?" Again, Reuben was concerned for his brother. But as the oldest, he could have stood up. It's like he's lost his moral authority. And even here, you see his statement concerning is more concerned with himself at the moment. He might be concerned with his brother, but his statement is, where shall I go? What am I going to have to say to my father? What's going to become of me? And again, just more sin and dysfunction. Now moving on to, I think we're in the next chapter, verse 1. Oh, chapter 39. Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house, and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house, and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. And so we see here just immense favor that God is bestowing upon Joseph. Here affliction has come upon Joseph. He's been sold into slavery, but now we're seeing the favor of God. And I believe from what we've already seen, of Joseph's self-centered indifference to his brother's feelings, his arrogance, the spoiled kind of a brat of a kid, we're seeing now this idea of the unmerited favor that God is giving him. He's not getting favor because he's such a great person, or, oh, God feels sorry for him because he's had to suffer a little bit. There's something else going on here. And so he's receiving this favor from Joseph, and God is blessing everything that Joseph does, to the point that Potiphar just like says, hey, just take care of everything. And he doesn't do anything anymore. All he has to worry about is, where's my food? Joseph is running the whole household. And when we think about Potiphar, this is a guy in power. It says he's the officer of Pharaoh. He's the captain of the guard. He's probably like a general in an army, more of like a Marcus Aurelius in the Roman army. He's not just some guy with a small office. He's probably a person with significant power, and a significant amount of wealth, and a significant amount of responsibility. And now Joseph is overseeing all of this stuff, and God is pouring out blessing and favor. And says continually that the Lord was with Joseph. I think in the story it raises the question of which came first, because what we're going to see is amazing character in the life of Joseph, to where you could really just preach this message and just say all these awesome things that Joseph does and just be like, look at Joseph, hey, be like Joseph. But I don't think that's the point. And I don't think that's ever the point of any of the stories we read, is to look at that person and make an example of them and then say, hey, let's go be like that. We talked about this idea before, that there are no heroes in this book. There are just flawed people. The hero is God. The hero is Jesus Christ. And so we ask the question, which came first? The faithfulness that we're going to see that comes out of Joseph, or God's faithfulness, God's favor? And I think that it's pretty clear that God's favor in Joseph's life is a picture of God's grace, and it's something that comes first. It's not something that Joseph did to earn it. We don't see Joseph first being faithful. We see this reality being spoken to us first, that God shows favor to Joseph, and he blesses Joseph, and out of this, I think we see a transformation in Joseph's life. And so what God is doing is not a result of Joseph's goodness, but it's grace. And this is what's true of every believer, is that we receive what we don't deserve. We receive this unmerited favor. God bestows his blessing upon us, not because we deserve it, but because he's merciful and loving and good. And so here's one of the first examples of Joseph's character. And I believe that as the grace of God comes upon us, and as we realize that God is with us, and we surely we think about where we've come from, the conviction of the Holy Spirit comes upon us. Joseph had to be thinking along the way, as he was crying out to his brothers, as he was tied up, being taken to Egypt, days, you know, I don't know what his circumstances were, as he stood in the marketplace to be bought as a piece of property by Potiphar, and he's had to think already, working as a slave, how did I get here? Why did my brothers do this to me? And he had to ponder himself and his life and look back on what took place. And I think it would be difficult for him to not see some of what actually went down. And even though that the text doesn't tell us this, we see such a change in Joseph that it seems to be that Joseph, having pondered where he's come from, And then seeing the favor of God gets impacted in a way where God has taken him through this affliction. He's taken them through this suffering, but to do good in his life and to reveal truth and to reveal God's own character to him. And now we see the outworking of that in Joseph's character here in verse 6 of chapter 39. It says, "Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, 'Lie with me.' But he refused and said to his master's wife, 'Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept anything back from me except you, because you're his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?'" And so we're told, Joseph's handsome, just so happens to be handsome, just so happens to be lovely in form and appearance. And this bored wife in this position of power casts her eyes on him. She's checking him out. And she decides to go after him. Now, I think what's happening here, it's obviously this lustful kind of thing, but there's also this power struggle going on, I think. Tim Keller points out this phrase, "lie with me," the Hebrew word behind this being an imperative verb, it's more of a command. And when we read it, we might think it sounds like a request, you know, lie with me, but it isn't. It is like a command from someone who has power and has authority in this house talking to this slave. Tim Keller says it might be, you could almost word it like she's saying sex now, like she's just commanding him to do this. But he's refusing. And he could even be afraid of her power and what she could do, but he's not willing to do this. And then he calls what she's asking him to do a great wickedness and a sin, not just against Potiphar, but against God. And so you see a faith that Joseph is having in God, and that this would be a wrong against God, the God who has shown him favor. Because right before that he says, "I am not greater in this house," or, you know, he's basically on the same level of his master. And he knows that God is the one who has blessed him and given him all that he has. And he knows that this would be a sin against God. And so he resists her. And basically, she ends up pursuing him like crazy. It says day after day, she's trying to get him. But it seems from the story that he was careful to not be alone with her or to avoid her. Because day after day, this is happening, but nothing really comes of it. Until one day, it says, he's in the house. And there's nobody in the house. And what goes down, we see in verse 12. She catches him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." She says it again. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. So he bolts. He's not going to wait. He's not going to mess around with this temptation. And he runs out so fast, she's got his garment. And I think you really see not only what we've already seen in the faith of Joseph growing, but the fear of the Lord that he has here. A fear of the Lord that he knows he should flee temptation. And so I think we see that there's an increasing character growing in Joseph. And I do believe that this is a result of grace. If you compare this with his brother Judah in 38, who just like temptation, just instantly, let's turn in here and go for it. There's something different going on through Joseph, because God has intervened in a radical way in Joseph's life, and he's intervened beginning with bringing great affliction into Joseph's life. So she's got the garment, and she calls them into the house and says, "See, he's brought among us this Hebrew to laugh at us," talking about her husband. And so she brings out this false accusation, and I think that she likes power. You know, it's like it probably offended her, I'm sure, greatly, like it would anybody when they say, "Hey, let's go do this thing," and you're like, "That's a great wickedness," and people don't like that. And so not only that, he's like, you know, people want what they don't have. Like you hear of girls going after the bad guy. He treats her horribly, but because he's always dissing her, she's always like, "I need his approval." And I think in this case, she kept trying to get that, trying to have that power. And when she finally couldn't, she's like, "Well, I'll take the power another way." And she falsely accuses him. And in verse 19, chapter 39, she tells her husband, and it says, "As soon as his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him, 'This is the way your servant has treated me,' his anger was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. So we see the ongoing continued favor of the Lord. And yet, you know, Joseph at the point of being in Potiphar's house surely might have thought, you know, things are going well. And this is what happens to us, right? Life is cruising along. Everything's good. Life is good. God is good. You know, God loves me because everything's going well. And then, bam, something hits and just rips our life to shreds. He goes from being in this great place of prominence and being respected even by Potiphar, not really being like treated like a slave out in the field, but treated like a manager, a leader. And now he's in the prison, basically being accused of being a rapist. He's, you know, it talks about him later of being in the pit. So it's like he's been in the pit before from his brothers, and now he's in the pit again. And yet, we see the continued favor of God, and that everything that Joseph does, even here, succeeds because the Lord is the one who makes it succeed. God, in his sovereignty, is working things out to unfold this plan and accomplish his purposes. In Joseph's life, for him as an individual, but then in all of the things that go beyond Joseph. And we see that in verse 23, that, you know, the keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything, just like Potiphar. God so blesses Joseph and so gives him wisdom and is so equipping him with what he needs that he just becomes this picture of reliability. And everyone can count on him. They don't even have to think about it. Just put Joseph in charge and everything will get taken care of. But we see that behind this, it's always the Lord. It's not Joseph because he's so wise or so smart or so great, but that the Lord is with him and the Lord is making him succeed. And then as the story progresses, Joseph's in prison and two dudes get thrown in prison with him. These guys are guys in power. They're in Pharaoh's court. You got a chief cupbearer and a chief baker. And something happened. It doesn't tell us what, but they're thrown in prison. And then in Genesis chapter 40 in verse 4, it says the captain of the guard appointed Joseph to be with them and he attended them and they continued for some time in custody. Now, I don't think so many years have gone by here. Even when we look at the lifespan of Joseph, how long he was, probably 13 years a slave, and then other things happen. It's doubtful that this captain of the guard is someone other than the captain of the guard we've already heard of, Potiphar. And I think that the likelihood is that this is Potiphar, because what you have here are two guys that need to be protected as they're put in prison, because these guys are owned by Pharaoh. And if Pharaoh wants to have them killed, that's fine with Pharaoh, but nothing better accidentally happen to these guys if you're in charge, or you are going to be in serious trouble when you answer to Pharaoh, who is revered as God in this culture. And so the captain of the guard has to find somebody reliable to watch over these two guys. And so who does he find? He appoints Joseph to be with them. And I think this is interesting, if this is indeed Potiphar, and I do think it most likely is that even though all of these things happen with this accusation, some time has gone by, and I can't help but wonder if Potiphar has pondered the character of his wife and watching what she does, you know, and thinking about, you know, some of the things that people say, and then pondering that Joseph could always be relied on, that he was always a person of integrity, that he was a faithful person, and even here showing that this captain of the guard entrusts these two people in his custody. It seems that you know, Potiphar has probably considered this about Joseph. And, you know, he wouldn't want to go back on his word and embarrass himself. He certainly wouldn't want to take the side of a slave over his wife. But maybe he knows something. I don't know. Either way, God's sovereignly working, and Joseph is with these two guys. And what happens is these guys both have a dream on the same night, and they end up super troubled. And so Joseph comes along as he's called to take care of them, and he inquires why they're troubled. It says in verse 8 of 40, chapter 40, they said to him, "We have had dreams, and there's no one to interpret them." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." And so the chief cupbearer steps forward to tell his dream. And in verse 12, Joseph, who has already said that the interpretations come from God, "Do not interpretations belong to God?" So he's giving credit where credit's due and where the interpretation is going to come from.
But then Joseph says this is its interpretation. Genesis 40, verse 13. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head. I'm not going to tell the dream. You can go back and read it to see how that unfolds. But this is its interpretation. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office. And you shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand as formerly when you were his cupbearer. Only remember me when it is well with you. And please do me kindness to mention me to Pharaoh. And so get me out of this house. So Joseph has a faith in God, but he's not passive. I think he's looking for opportunities. I think Joseph has been put in positions of leadership, and I think God has given him a great deal of wisdom. And he knows that God just gave him the interpretation to this dream, and maybe this is going to be his way out of this house. So please remember me when you get out of here that I was able to do this for you. And basically the chief cupbearer, or the chief baker, who's holding back, and I think we find out why later, he's probably guilty. He doesn't want to tell his dream. But once he sees that the other guy got a favorable interpretation, he's like, oh, let me tell you my dream. He steps forward, tells his dream, and then he gets his interpretation. Not quite the same. Verse 19, this is the interpretation given to the chief baker. It says, Joseph speaking, in 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat the flesh from you. On the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants and lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his position and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand, but he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. And so God's still at work. God has his timing for things. God is bringing all of these things about to accomplish his purposes. And 2 whole years go by, and Joseph's still hanging out in prison, not going anywhere. Things are probably looking bleak. But then Pharaoh just so happens to have some dreams. And once again, Pharaoh is troubled like all the rest of the characters because there's no one to interpret his dreams. Genesis chapter 41, verse 8, it says, so in the morning his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was none who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, I remember my offenses today, when Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me and the chief baker in custody in the house of the captain of the guard. We dreamed on the same night, he and I, each having a dream with its own interpretation. A young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. When we told him, he interpreted our dreams to us, giving an interpretation to each man according to his dream. And as he interpreted to us, so it came about. I was restored to my office, and the baker was hanged. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I have heard it said of you that you hear a dream, that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. So Pharaoh has looked throughout the land. No one can interpret it. And he's looking to Joseph and he's saying, I've heard you can interpret the dream. And Joseph, who has seen God at work in his life, who has been encountering the grace of God, and who has already been giving God glory with his life, immediately deflects this and gives glory to God. And he credits the interpretation to the God who reveals it. It's a reminder of what Daniel does, that all these guys in the story of the Bible, who God is doing these great things to and allowing them to give these interpretations to people who are in immense power in the world, some of the most powerful people in all the world during their time. And Daniel also does this when he's interpreting. And he says in Daniel 2:21, speaking of God, that God changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things, and he knows what's in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. But it's that idea that God is sovereign, that he is the one orchestrating things, that he is the one behind the raising up a king and the bringing down of a king. If someone has knowledge and understanding, it's been given to them by God. And he's the one who reveals the deep and hidden things. And so Joseph does this same thing. In verse 16 of Genesis 41, Joseph answered Pharaoh, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. And so Joseph is here You know, he's finally got his opportunity to just like focus on himself, kind of like his brothers were doing. And what is he doing? He's living like a missionary. He's in a foreign culture, in a foreign land, and he's giving witness to the glory of God, to the greatness of God. And God will give a favorable answer, and he's confident that God will do this, and that he knows that he's going to be able to interpret this, and that it's flowing from God. And so Pharaoh tells him the dream. I'm going to cut out reading that because it's too long, but Joseph gives him the interpretation. Genesis 41:28, and it says, "It is as I told Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he's about to do. There will come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, there will arise 7 years of famine, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will consume the land, and the plenty will be unknown in the land by reason of the famine that will follow, for it will be very severe." And the doubling of Pharaoh's dream means that the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it about. And so a thing can be fixed by God because God is sovereign. He is the one orchestrating all of the things throughout the story and in the life of Joseph. And I think Joseph understands this, and he understands that the interpretation of this dream, that this dream is fixed. Nothing can stop this from coming to pass, and it's right around the corner. God is going to shortly bring it about. And we see the unfolding of God's continued favor in Joseph's life. And we move forward in Genesis 41, verse 33. Joseph, having given this interpretation and laid out the meaning of Pharaoh's dreams, now gives Pharaoh advice. Here's what you should do. He says, "Now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. That food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through famine." This proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. So when we look at the life of Joseph, God was preparing Joseph. He's got his agricultural skills. He's got leadership and management skills. He's been put in charge of all kinds of things, and he's obviously been given great wisdom. And here his wisdom is displayed. He immediately knows what needs to be done. No one has to tell him. This is all flowing from God who is at work in his life. The one thing, though, that I think that we don't see that used to come out of the narrative is the arrogance of Joseph. You don't see Joseph boasting, you know, "Hey, bow down before me." You even see Joseph saying, "Well, God's the one, not me." And it's a big shift from the 17-year-old punk that he was. And I think what we see is that Joseph's been broken, right? This is what God does. This is the challenge of what it means to be a Christian as we're trusting in God and a God who's sovereign, is that God takes us through trials and affliction. And sometimes those things are unspeakable or they're so hard to understand, or things that happened in our childhood or things that have happened in our life, and we have no answer for them. And I think even if we look for the answer, we can't find it. You know, we're not going to see like, "Oh, well, this happened and then I became like the second most powerful person in the world, so God's okay." Like, no, it doesn't work out like that. We kind of see some amazing things in the life of Joseph, and we'll see more of that in part 2 of this. But it's not just for Joseph's sake that God is doing these things. God is doing a million things. And even beyond what we hear in this narrative, God's doing so much that we can't be assuming that there's just always going to be this like one-to-one relationship. Well, suffering and here's the blessing. Or, oh, here's the reason God did it. The majority of time, probably almost always, we're not going to know why things have happened this side of eternity. We're not going to have an explanation or reason. Maybe once in a while things will reveal themselves of why I went through this and God was equipping me for stuff. But at the end of the day, God needs us to be a broken people who rely upon Him. And when we're walking in self-sufficiency and self-righteousness, we think that, "Hey, I'm pretty smart, or I'm pretty clever, or I'm pretty moral, or I'm a pretty good person," and we rely upon ourselves, and it never brings us to the point of our knees where we learn to completely rely upon God and trust in Him and point to Him and give Him glory. And we don't end up bearing fruit. We don't end up having the life that He's calling us to have and to find our fullness in Him. And so in Genesis 41:38, as this carries on, Joseph is given his advice and the Pharaoh responds. Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom the Spirit is the Spirit of God? I mean, this is amazing. You've got Pharaoh, pretty much at this time, probably the most powerful person in the world, who would be revered as God. They would call these guys God. And these guys were like walking God on earth. And here Pharaoh says, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? He's recognizing like God in Joseph, like, hey, Joseph is something unusual. This guy's amazing, but he's recognizing where it's coming from. And he goes on. This is mind-blowing. Verse 39, Pharaoh says to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. That's pretty amazing for Pharaoh to say that to a slave boy. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regard to the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. And then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. And he made him ride in his second chariot. And they called out before him, bow the knee. Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh. And without your consent, no one shall lift up a hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him in marriage Asnath, the daughter of Potiphar, a priest of On. So Joseph went out over the land of Egypt. So God has brought Joseph into a position of power, but God had to make Joseph ready for this. Pharaoh's saying, like, only basically in the fact that I have this title am I greater than you, but you're gonna wear my ring, you're gonna ride in my chariot. So now, just like Potiphar, just like the keeper of the prison, Joseph is going to oversee all of the affairs for all of the nation of Egypt, which is a powerhouse in every way, economically, militarily. This is amazing. This is amazing. And it can only happen, I believe, because God is sovereign and that he's working so mysteriously through the most amazing and difficult circumstances. So God's brought Joseph into power, but it's for the purposes that he has. It reminds us of Romans 8:28, where, speaking of believers, it says that we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. And that's always the thing that we need to remind ourselves. It's not just, hey, all things are working for good so it can end with me. Like, it's all about me. Like, we're so that way. I know I am. It's like, well, I'm always so self-absorbed that it's like, well, when I look at circumstances in my life, it's like, well, is it working out for me? But what about the millions of other things God is doing to work things out for good and for his glory? And so it's not just that all things are going to work out good in the sense that it all has to work out according to my plan, but it's always going to bring about good, and God's going to accomplish things according to his purpose, like he is in this story. And so Joseph here is 30 years old, it tells us in the text, and he was 17 when he was sold into slavery. So he's spent about 13 years as a slave. The seven plentiful years are going to come, and he'll be 37, 7 years of famine in the middle of that when we get into the next part of the story. He's well into his 40s. The majority of the best years of his life are gone, and he has seen affliction. He knows the meaning of hardship. He knows what it means to suffer. And we see this even, that this hasn't missed him. He hasn't just seen the blessing of God. He has agonized, and we see it in the naming of his children. Genesis 41, verse 51, it says, Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. So he's got all this hardship. He's got these open wounds. And what else does he want to forget? He wants to forget his father's house, the pain of what happened. His whole, all this group of his brothers betraying him, wanting to kill him, selling him away. And he's never tried. I mean, he's powerful now. He could try to go home, but that's not happened. He's saying, God has let me forget my father's house. I have to leave that behind me. And so there's this open, gaping wound that we'll deal with more in part two of this sermon. But then he goes on and he names his second born Ephraim, saying, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. And so what you see here is he knows that God has blessed him. But there's not any like prosperity gospel here. There's not like a, hey, God's made me fruitful and everything always works out, and because I did good, it always equates to like blessing for me, or I did the right thing with, you know, Potiphar's wife scenario, and so that worked out good. Well, you know, it didn't really for quite a long time. It actually worked out worse for him, and he's been blessed and he's fruitful, but in the land of his affliction. He calls this place that he has been made this powerful person. He's been given a family. He's been given a new name. He's integrated into the Egyptian culture, and he's continuing to give glory to God. It doesn't seem to appear that in any way he's assimilated himself into the beliefs of the Egyptians. He's held fast to the God that he knows. But he's made his home here, and he has a different kind of identity. He's tried to forget what's behind him, and he calls this the land of his affliction. And this is the thing. When we're thinking about the economy of God's sovereignty, when we consider a God who's in control, it's often a struggle when we think about our lives that are also marked with affliction, with hardship and suffering. And I know, you know, if you're here for the sharing time, there's suffering. And there's a lot of suffering that a lot of us don't just openly speak about. I know from a few people and from people who I know closely or people who have shared, there's some very difficult things that have happened. Some things that I don't pretend to have some quick and easy answer for. All I can do is know what I believe Joseph knows, and what I believe God would have us know from this story is that God meant it for good. And that is really the thrust that I've been after in unfolding this story. Did Joseph know that God meant all of this affliction for good? And he did. The Bible tells us later in Genesis 50:20, these are Joseph's words speaking to his brothers. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So as we'll get there next time, during this time of famine, he's encountering his brothers and he's telling them, you meant this for evil. Like, I know you meant this evil. By their own free will actions, of which they are fully accountable for, they meant this thing to be brought about for evil, but God meant for it to be brought about for good. And so this is a pretty big, there's a lot of theology in this one verse. It's a pretty big deal. Because what we see here is the way that God's sovereignty works in the world. I'm going to run just a couple minutes over. I don't want to end right here, but the NIV actually translates this word meant, God meant, as intended. God intended. It can also have the connotation of planning or devising or even weaving in some cases. This idea is that this is exactly what God intended. This wasn't an afterthought. This wasn't, hey, you guys, you know, you came up with this evil scheme that you meant to do against me, and God then in reaction kind of worked it out for good. Sure, God could do that, but that's not what it's telling us. It's saying that what they intended, that they freely did, God intended. In other words, God ordained this to come to pass. And John Piper's a guy who really does a good job of this. I think he even wrote a book on it. But he shows how this is fleshed out in the cross. This theology is fleshed out in the very gospel, the very good news that we believe in, because everything that took place by the free actions of men who sinned against the Christ was ordained by God and prophesied so long before that it would go down a certain way, and it went down exactly that way. God was going to see that that was going to come to pass, and God meant it for good. And just like this story, God meant it for good to bring about the salvation of many people. Let me just read the end of Genesis 41, starting in verse 53. The 7 years of plenty that occurred in the land of Egypt came to an end. So we're entering famine. The 7 years of famine began to come, and Joseph had said there was famine in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. When all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph, what he says you do. So when the famine had spread all over all the land, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt, to Joseph, to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth. And so here we see the unfolding of this reality, that what the brothers intended for evil, God meant for good, and he meant it for good to bring about the keeping alive of many people, as Joseph says, as they are today. And so all that God was doing did not terminate and end on Joseph. It wasn't just about Joseph. Even in Abraham, it's not like, I'll bless you so you can just be blessed. I will bless you that in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And we'll get more into this next time. But this idea of all the earth coming into Egypt as God sovereignly orchestrates this is a picture of God's heart for the nations as he reveals his glory to peoples who would come here. And who would they speak to? Joseph, who believes in this God, who's learned to trust in this God. And so in that same way, God, this is just the foreshadowing of what God has done. That God has taken the evil of the people who were beating Jesus and crying out, who hit you? Tell us. Or come down from the cross. Or ripping the flesh from his back. And all the things that were pure sin and yet ordained by God, God meant those for good to bring about the salvation of many people. Even in this story, it just so happened. I'm out of time, so I won't go down the line. But all of those things that just so happened, right? It all had to go exactly how it did for Joseph to be kept alive, for Joseph's character to be kept alive, and in the next part, for reconciliation and a transformation to take place in the rest of the family that was about to implode, this dysfunctional family. And so God is accomplishing all of these things. He's accomplishing his glory, just showing and revealing his glory throughout the earth as these things take place. He's accomplishing the character growth and salvation of Joseph. He's accomplishing what he's going to do in the rest of the family. And he's always at work doing so many different things all at once in his sovereign plan. And it takes us being able to put trust in him, because sometimes that plan, like Joseph's life, can be years of affliction, horrific affliction, of a broken wound, of a family in disarray like this. But I believe that if we will, even in seeing this story, be willing to see that picture of God's sovereignty, but the goodness of God in his sovereignty. Not a skepticism or a cynical view about it or a distrust because, oh, you know, he's in control, but what about the million things that we can run through that don't seem to connect and line up with that? I believe God would call us to look at the cross and look and see that in God taking the things meant for evil in that scenario and in this story, God meant it for good, that he calls us and invites us in to come and know him, to know that Jesus came to pay the price for our sins, that we could have life, that we could be free, that we could know him, that we could enter not into a religion, not into a moralism, not into a bunch of lists of do-goodisms, but into a relationship of knowing Jesus personally. As you've seen in these stories that have been unfolding, people can't just know about God. We need to know him in here. We need to trust in him. We need to get rid of the disproportionate affections of our heart like Jacob had, the constant idols that war within us. And we all have them. You know, they look different, but we all struggle in different ways with that, that we want to put something else in the place that only God can fill and only God belongs. And we'll always end up empty when we try to go to those other things and say, that's what I need, that will fill, that will satisfy me. And not only that, we will bring destruction to the relationships and things around us when we're trying to fill ourselves with anything else. Only when we've found our satisfaction in God and know him can we then just allow God to just pour blessing out of us into the people around us. Can we just glorify him with who we are? And of course, we'll stumble along the way, but God will accomplish his purposes for his people. And he'll do good in our lives. Well, I'm going to wrap up, but I just want to invite anyone who hasn't put their faith in God to put their faith in him this morning. And that, you know, you come here with possibly being someone who's been afflicted, or maybe you've been in someone who's been doing the evil. But regardless, God can take the things that are broken in your life and turn them around for good. And he can heal the wounds, and he can cover the sins, and he can make you whole. And he can make you new. And so he invites you to have life by trusting in him. Let's close in prayer. Lord, I just thank you that as we read these stories, what we continually see are people with massive flaws. And yet we see your steadfast love. We see your faithfulness. We see your goodness. And we see that you are in control. Lord, help us to be able to trust that you are both sovereign and that you are good. That you are mighty enough to bring us through whatever we will go through in life, and that we can put our full trust in you. Help our affections to be in the right proportion as far as our relation to you. Lord, guard us from the temptations to put other things in that place, Lord, and growth us as your people. Help us as we go through trials. Strengthen us in our faith and help us to be a witness to you in the world and help more and more people in this community and beyond come to know you, Lord. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.